Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. This week, we're celebrating the 45th anniversary of Earth Day. Later in the program, your hosts Pat Schlarbaum and Susan Franson will be joined by Larry Stone, John Stravers, and Mark Edwards to talk about the development of Earth Day. But for the beginning of our program, we will be talking with Chris Anderson and Catherine Hayhoe. Would you both introduce yourselves?
I'm Chris Anderson, and I'm here from Ames, Iowa. I work at the university. I have a research faculty position in the Department of Agronomy, and I work on climate science as it relates to decision-making a lot, primarily recently with farmers, as well as with just finished a pilot study with the Department of Transportation and their bridges. The one comment I want to say before I let Catherine introduce herself is your comment about climate change being a crazy term is that there's actually a discussion amongst climate scientists about that as well. Some are arguing that we should never say climate change because climate is always changing. The question is, what is causing?
So my name is Catherine Hayhoe, and I am also a climate scientist at Texas Tech University. So I'm visiting from down south, and people yesterday were apologizing for how windy it was here, and I said, are you kidding? This is a mild breeze compared to where I come from, not to mention there's no dust or large pieces of tumbleweed flying around. So I study climate change and what it means to us in the places where we live, similar to what Chris does. I really think of this issue of climate urgency as one that matters to us personally, not necessarily because we care about the polar bears or the birds or the bugs or the trees. It's because we care about our water resources. We care about our economy. We care about our agriculture. We care about national security. We care about the health of ourselves and our families. And these are the things that are being impacted by climate change today.
One of the things that interested me in the things that I have read and heard about you is that although you are a climate scientist, you talk very little about the science. You go directly to what people care about. And, of course, it depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to conservative Christians, you speak the language that you and they share, the language of the Bible. And you had a beautiful quotation in the article in the Des Moines Register. Well, it was God wrote the Bible, but nature is the illustration.
Yes. Okay, I have to admit I stole that quote. But it's a great quote on the idea that the Bible is God's written word, but nature are the illustrations to that. And so when we look at what we believe and then we look at what the world around us is telling us, if they appear to be in conflict, it's because we don't fully understand one or the other or both. With the issue of climate change, though, there really isn't a conflict. Now, there's certainly, you know, if you turn on your TV or you go to your favorite news site, you can certainly see a conflict. But, for example, if we look at the Bible, we see God gave this earth with all the living things on it to people, to humans, to be responsible for. So we're not usurping the role of God. We are the ones who are responsible. And we also see how we are to care for not just creation and nature, but people. And so, again, this is a people issue. It's not a polar bear issue. So often we feel like to care about these issues, we need to have green values. So if we are already a tree hugger, if we already eat granola, if we already bike to work, then we're okay. It's all right to care about these things. But if we're not that type of person, then this just isn't on our radar. I think that each of us already has all the values we need to care about the fact that our choices are changing the climate of this planet, and it's impacting, again, it's impacting our water, our health, our agriculture, our economy, our national security. So what I try to do is not try to, you know, create new green values in people. I think we already have the values we need. We just need to connect those values. As Chris said yesterday, I think connect the dots between those values and this issue, because we already have all the reason in the world to care.
Yes. Well, now to get to us and what we care about, I'd like to go back to Chris, because he's an agronomist right here in what used to be originally the Iowa State Agricultural College, and still has a huge, huge agricultural component, very important. Mm-hmm.
And so how did you get into climate change? Mm.
So my background in climate change actually comes out of my interest in storms. When I was going through college, there are basically two types of meteorologists. There are the types that were born just infatuated with weather. And so at an age of as young as 6 or 7, I can remember just being fascinated by storms. So I'm that kind of meteorologist. The other type when I was going through college were people who had come over from engineering, especially electrical engineering at that time. They had all the math skills, but they could see that they weren't going to get a job. So they decided to become a meteorologist. Since then, what has happened is I've worked a lot with rainfall patterns, and that naturally is very important to agriculture. So there becomes now this intersection between what I know about the processes of rainfall and also the statistical nature of rainfall and how that impacts agriculture. And so during the late 90s and into the early 2000s, I became very interested in finding out how well climate models and how well climate simulations handle those precipitation patterns and if they're realistic or not. And from there, I've just continued to work through some climate model development, but since about 2007 or so, maybe 2008, work much more on the side of, okay, it's fine to understand what's going on in the model, but what we need to really transition to in the near term is how we use all that information wisely. And so since about 07 and 08, I've been much more focused on how do you use that information in smart ways.
Well, I have a question about meteorology mm-hmm. because I mentioned that my husband was a physical chemist, but when mm-hmm. he retired, he actually took two or three meteorology courses. His idea was that he would be able to talk to climate deniers, climate change deniers. And among the earliest ones he found were meteorologists. Could you – you're nodding. You apparently are familiar with that. Can you explain why that would have been?
Yeah, I think the main part of that is there's a disconnect between what climate science does and what meteorologists do. Meteorologists are very in tune to the day-to-day weather patterns. For a climate scientist, the fundamental thing is the energy balance of the Earth. And that changes over very long periods of time, whereas meteorologists will look day to day at the weather patterns. And so if you ever have any inclination that the weather patterns haven't changed so much, then the meteorologists would say, I haven't seen any changes. Why should I believe in climate change?
And a great analogy to picture that is, when you're walking a dog and you're walking straight along the sidewalk or the path, and the dog is going far over to the left, sniffing that tree, then over to the right, peeing in the bush, and then over to the left again to sniff what some other dog left. And so climate is like you walking along the path, a slow, steady progression in one direction. But weather is like the dog running forth in these huge zigzags from side to side. And so meteorologists focus on the dog. Climate scientists focus on the person.
Fritz really thinks that the word global energy balance should be the defining term, and of course this is a scientist term. This is a specific term. It's hard to make it a popular term.
Absolutely.
But climate urgency or climate catastrophe, is better.
Urgency is better. Yeah. Because catastrophe implies there's nothing you can do but get out of the way. And I think that the message that we want to talk about tonight and that Chris continually talks about here in Iowa is there is so much that we can do, but we need to do it now.
Yes, that is something that is hard to grasp, because sometimes when I listen to some of the things you're talking about, the people who, quote, believe in climate change. And I loved your answer when somebody asked if you believed in climate change. Could you explain what you said?
Well, my answer is very simple. The answer is no, I don't believe in global warming or climate change. That's because I think whether you go to Google or whether you go to the Bible, you get the same definitions of science and faith, which I think is very interesting. Science is the evidence of what our eyes tell us. Science is based on observation and data. In science, if you form a theory, if it can never be tested, then it's not really a good scientific theory. Whereas faith is the opposite. Faith is the evidence of what we do not see. And so science is not something you believe in or not, because whether you believe in gravity or not, If you jump off a tall cliff, gravity will still work. So with global warming, with climate change, with climate urgency, with how we see the world around us changing as a result of our choices, it's not a matter of opinion. There's over 26,500 indicators of a changing climate, many of them in our own backyards. So it isn't something I believe in. I look at the data, I look at what the world is telling us, and we know that it is happening.
But, of course, you really do need that faith, whatever you understand of the facts, because it's the faith that gives you the hope.
Absolutely.
Well, now, just what is it that we can do here in Iowa that will make a difference? I understand that you are talking about the farmers and businesses in central Iowa being leaders. Now, that's a pretty bold statement.
Well, what we have done is we have highlighted some of the investments and some of the things that we have accomplished in the state of Iowa for Catherine, and then she's been able to connect that, as we said earlier, connect the dots to the climate science from there. So, for example, I'll let her go into some more details on connecting the dots, but just to let you know how we've related to the businesses in Iowa is we've highlighted, for example, the city of Des Moines, which is one of the very first programs or one of the very first cities to be involved in a program that relates to greenhouse gases and sustainability. It's going to be a national rating system that they are testing out in Des Moines and other cities. And also Des Moines is part of the meetings that we'll be having this this coming summer, the climate science meetings, the international climate meetings. They have signed on with the mayor statements on climate change.
You mean the mayor of Des Moines?
The mayor of Des Moines
Frank
has.
Cowley,
that's
Tony.
Right. So they are very proactive in being involved in climate resilience and climate mitigation. And that's a star example in our state of how communities and the businesses that they foster can really engage in this. And then in a broader terms, of course, we've had wind energy and renewable energy investment for a very long time. And that has shined recently, and that is the path forward as well for us to continue to lead the nation. And then building out even further in renewable energies, we can find more advances in agriculture that would really be first in the world types of activities that would help us to sequester carbon out of the atmosphere and turn around the trends from being upward and more than just leveling them out to actually turning them around.
And we're going to be talking more about this tonight. So tonight at 7 o'clock in which building is it in, Chris?
This is in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union.
Okay. Tonight at 7 o'clock, I talk on climate urgency and how farmers and businesses can take the lead. Now, if people can't attend in person, there is going to be a live broadcast.
That's correct. It's simulcast, and this is actually a little bit new event for us at Iowa State to simulcast out of the Great Hall. So we have a lot of great technical help coming across the entire university to help us pull this off. So what you wanted to go to do is go to a website hosted by the Department of Agronomy, and that website is agron, A-G-R-O-N, iastate.edu/heyho, H-A-Y-H-O-E. Let me just spell the letters out one more time. A-G-R-O-N iastate.edu/HAYHOE.
Now, I have seen these click live link. Now, will that work?
I'm not sure. What happens is we have an actual web page that you go to, and once the event starts, it's just going to be streaming right there on that web page.
Yes. Well, I've gone to the web page where there's nothing's happening. So, but that's a much easier way to get there if you can. So I'll paste that in as well as trying.
I do believe the news statement from the university has a button where you can click, and it'll go to that web page also.
Okay.
So if you look through the university news, then you can get a click, or you can go to that
directly.
And the
screen is already up, so it's just waiting for the live video feed, yes.
Well, on our programs, we usually try to put the links to that our speakers mentioned.
Sure.
So
okay.
I have already pre-tested that.
I should also mention that Chris is going to be taking live questions on Twitter. So if anybody is technologically inclined and does Twitter, you can send your questions to IA Agron, is it?
It's at ISU Agronomy.
There we go. At ISU Agronomy.
At ISU Agronomy.
And you can send them ahead of time if you know what you want to ask.
Right.
Or you can send them at any time during the talk, and we'll have quite a long period of time afterwards to address these questions. And then also, today, the organization Upworthy, some people may know Upworthy, they share stories worth knowing, they're going to be doing a live Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Central that I'm going to be participating in. They have 10 questions that they're asking people about climate change. And so there's going to be a lot of interesting answers. So if you're on Twitter at 11 a.m., Upworthy will be talking about climate change. And then at 7 o'clock, ISU Agronomy will be taking questions on the talk.
One of the things that interested me enormously when I first listened to programs by you, Catherine, was your background, where you grew up, what your family was like, and your shock when you got to graduate school in Illinois. So could you tell us a little about that, your story?
So I'm Canadian. I'm originally from Toronto. When I was 9 years old, we moved down to Colombia in South America and lived there off and on until I came back to go to university in Canada. So it wasn't, you know, Canadians do a lot of cross-border shopping, and we do a lot of trips to Florida. So it wasn't like I hadn't been to the U.S. before. I'd been there quite a bit. But it wasn't until I moved down to the U.S. to go to graduate school at University of Illinois, so just, you know, a few hours away over there in Urbana-Champaign. It wasn't until I moved down there to study atmospheric science, to study climate, that I realized that there's so many people who didn't think that climate change is real. Because up in Canada, I mean, and frankly, most of the rest of the world, you know, the sky is blue, the grass is green, climate is changing due to human choices, and we also care about air pollution and water quality and things like that. So it wasn't until I was in graduate school that I realized that I was actually studying this very politically controversial topic. And the controversy, politically speaking, has only grown. In fact, the latest surveys after the midterm elections show that climate change has become the most politically divisive issue in the United States, which I think is absolutely crazy because, as my husband says, a thermometer is not Democrat or Republican. It just tells you what the temperature is. Speaking of my husband, though, that was part of the surprise because I met him at graduate school at University of Illinois. He was doing his PhD in linguistics. He's a smart person. He does data. He does experiments. He understands the scientific method. It wasn't until about 6 months after we got married that we realized that we were on opposite sides of the fence on this climate change issue. And you may say, well, what did we talk about? But I never even dreamed that somebody with that level of education would think that climate change wasn't real. And he never even dreamed who somebody who called themselves a Christian would think it was real. So it was a great shock when we discovered that. But it was also a great learning experience because I've learned since then, and research has shown, that it's not a case of not having information. And it's definitely not a case of not being smart. Because the most scientifically literate people in our society are the ones who are most polarized on the issue of climate change. So naively, often we say, oh, well, if we could just give, you know, if we could just explain this a better way, if we could just give people one more data set or one more experiment or one more scientific paper, or how about another scientific report? Let's write another report because the last one maybe wasn't clear enough. That whole naive approach falls into the trap of assuming that it's a deficit or a lack of information that is driving the divisiveness and all the debate we see on climate in the media and in politics. The reality is it isn't about the science. It's about the solutions. People disagree so strongly about the solutions that they're even willing to say it's not a real issue rather than saying it is a real issue, but I don't want to do anything about it.
That gets to another question I have. I noticed that in spite of the fact that you are the director of the Climate Center in Texas Tech, you are in the Department of Political Science.
That's right. And so I come from a physics and an atmospheric science background. So my traditional home is definitely not in political science. But I did something really unusual a few years ago. I switched departments in the university. And, you know, we always do things for multiple reasons. But one of the main reasons that I really wanted to make that switch was because I was becoming increasingly aware that the roadblock here on addressing this climate urgency issue, the roadblock was not in the science. In the science, on the issue of is climate changing, are humans responsible, And what are the impacts of the choices we are making today on our future and our children? In climate science at this point, we've already crossed the T's and dotted the I's. At this point, we're drawing, you know, little flowers over the I's and we're doing, you know, curlicues over the T's. The roadblock is in implementing solutions. And political science is really, I think, at the forefront of understanding how we can do something about this urgent issue.
So what are some of the things that you can do through political science besides that very shocking study that, you know, mm-hmm. first the most divisive issue between Republicans mm-hmm. and Democrats is the president, the second is climate change.
That's right. And then the third is gun control, which is not surprising. The fourth is, do you trust scientists? Which, I mean, as I've said before, is do you trust your accountant on the list? No. How about do you trust your auto mechanic or do you trust your physician? I mean, it would be shocking to most of us if those things were politically divisive, yet somehow do you trust scientists is an acceptable thing to disagree on.
The other big, big thing is economics, because there's a pretty standard belief, not just between Democrats and Republicans, but even those who are climate scientists supporters and those who are deniers, that the economy is really going to be very severely negatively impacted if we try to do serious mitigation. Mm-hmm. And I think that is where political science probably comes in. So mm-hmm. what have you found?
And economics.
I mean economics,
yes,
really.
Yes, and that's definitely a lot of what we're going to be talking about tonight, because I think one of the most pervasive myths is exactly that, that doing something will cost us and doing nothing will be free. It's exactly the opposite. We are already paying for the disruption that we are seeing in our weather patterns, in our climate extremes. We're seeing stronger hurricanes, more frequent heavy rain and snow events, increased risk of flooding in many parts of the country, stronger droughts as temperatures rise, and incredible events like the event they're seeing in California where, you know, California gets droughts. That's part of life in California. But this drought they're seeing in California is stronger and lasting much longer than it would have because of the disruption in our climate system. So we are paying the price, make no mistake. And if we do not act to avoid further change, we'll be paying higher and higher and higher costs. But that's just one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is the fact that the clean energy economy is here. Last week, Chris sent me an article from Bloomberg Business, you know, not Greenpeace exactly, Bloomberg Business, saying this is the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era. We are seeing, for 2 years in a row, we've seen renewables outpace coal, natural gas, and oil put together. As someone famously said, the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stone. In the same way, the fossil fuel era is already beginning to end. China is number one in the world in wind energy. They're number two in solar. The U.S. is number two and number five, respectively. So it isn't about just – it isn't about, you know, oh, we have to cut back, use less, you know, have a lower quality of life. It's a matter of the new clean energy economy is charging ahead with or without us. The question is, are we going to be leading the way or are we going to be playing catch up 10 years from now?
And how does this play into the agricultural economy?
Well, I think one of the things that I have really been talking about a lot lately – with people in agriculture is that the folks who are trying to shape the marketplace for the clean economy is actually big oil, big energy companies themselves. Recently, there was a nice interview with the CEO of Shell, and he, in black and white, again in Bloomberg and elsewhere, is saying in no uncertain terms, climate change is real, climate change is a problem, and we have a solution, and we are not going to align with the deniers about climate change. Well, the reason why they would like to do that is because they would like to have a marketplace framework that has some predictability in it. And if that is the case, then they're able to price out their options and diversify their energy sources. And if there isn't predictability in the market, then perhaps they make plans for development projects that have 10 or 20-year horizons. And all of a sudden, the return on investment on those plans would change overnight if the predictability wasn't there. So the way that agriculture comes to the table is twofold. One, it has a technology that has been developed at Iowa State University that hasn't been demonstrated in the entire world that can be a very effective transition technology. It's a bio-oil that can be generated from the residue of corn and other crops. Or you could use grasses such as miscanthus and switchgrass to generate it. And when you mix this oil with coal, it burns just like coal. And when it burns just like coal, that means you can displace the amount of coal that you have in your coal-burning furnaces without making any changes to the furnaces whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So it's a very low capital investment option. Now, the only reason it hasn't really had any play is because, as I said, it's a brand new technology that's just been invented over the last 2 or 3 years. But it is a potential to dramatically reduce a reliance on coal. So that's one way agriculture can come to the table. The other way is, besides displacing coal and replacing coal and others, you need to also take carbon out of the air. Mm-hmm. It's not enough just to displace the fossil fuels. You have to take out of the air what we put already in there. And every year, we see the carbon dioxide go down when the northern hemisphere greens up. Mm-hmm. So we know for a fact we can sequester carbon. And agriculture, if it puts its mind to it and coordinates its activities, can be very effective at that.
I know there'll be a lot more tonight, 7 p.m., Great Hall, Memorial Union, or on one of those live links that we're going to experiment and hope that all that wonderful technology is going to work.
That's right. And so if you have friends or family that you want to share this with who are not in Ames, mm-hmm. you can just send them the link and they can watch along tonight.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both for being here. We've been talking with Catherine Hayhoe and Chris Anderson. And now we are going to shift to a different side of Earth Day. Thanks so much for being here with us on KHOI 89.1 this morning.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Susan.
For our phonology for today, let's focus upon peregrine falcons. Falcons are grouped with hawks, eagles, owls, and ospreys as birds of prey or raptors. They occupy the top of the food chain, meaning that all other birds and animals contribute to their well-being. As such, they are an indicator to the health of the environment. Their presence is a good thing. After the Second World War, a chemical was used to kill insects called DDT. When it got into the food chain, it was having a devastating effect on many wildlife species, but particularly raptors. Rachel Carson, a noted marine biologist, researched DDT's devastating effects and learned it was causing eggshell thinning and hampering reproduction in birds of prey. Her treatise was published in 1962 as Silent Spring. If the world proceeded on its course, there would be no more songbirds, game birds, or raptors. The chemical industry, however, sullied and demeaned and criticized her research and her career before she passed in 1964 of cancer. During the era of DDT and Silent Spring, peregrine falcons nested in cliffs along the Mississippi River in far northeast Iowa, in Allamaquia County. The last known nesting of peregrines in that era was near Capilli, upstream from Harper's Ferry. In spring 1965, falcons did not return to Capilli, and the cliffs along the greatest flyway on the planet were silent. Many species were devastated like peregrines. Even our bald eagles, our national symbol, came perilously close to being wiped out, for goodness sake. There were 427 nesting pairs of bald eagles and dwindling. Finally, DDT was banned in 1972, and the Endangered Species Act was signed. But peregrines were wiped out from the Missouri River to the East Coast. By 1977, falconers got together and began breeding their captive falcons. The peregrine became the standard bearer of the Endangered Species Act. States began releasing young falcons in cities where there were no great horned owls to prey on the peregrines. Iowa was successful in returning falcons to Des Moines and Cedar Rapids in 1993. In 1998, due to the presence of many falcons in the cities, the federal government was able to remove the peregrine falcon from the endangered status. However, they were still not nesting on their historic cliffs in northeast Iowa. Their last stronghold was on the cliffs. In 1997, Bob Anderson relocated his Raptor Resource Project from Minnesota to Iowa with the goal of releasing falcons on the cliffs. Having them imprint on that historic habitat and usher in their return as a nesting species. From his work and others, in 2000, 5 nesting pairs returned to the cliffs of the Mississippi, all within their historic range. They went from 0 to 5 nesting pairs in 1 year. due to Bob's work. The Cliffs welcomed the Falcon return, and they were upgraded from endangered status in Iowa in 2009. Each spring, falconers and other outdoor enthusiasts gather near Harpers Ferry for a Falcon River trip the first weekend of May. School groups are taken to the cliffs where they can hear the courtship calls of falcons once again. This year's event will undoubtedly enjoy nesting eagles, great blue herons and their nesting rookeries, and all the spring warblers will be enchanting and contributing to the migration. There's an original Mississippi River fish fry hosted each year on Friday night of the event at the Harpers Ferry Community Center. The Ho-Chunk Nation of Black River Falls, Wisconsin, approve of this work and come and assist also. Our boat captain is Robert Vavra with Maiden Voyages. We receive assistance with the Ho-Chunk Nation to ensure these birds fly freely from this generation to the next and the next forever. So plan to enjoy this unique outdoor experience the first weekend in May in Harpers Ferry, Iowa. Come to the cliffs to hear and see nature's most dynamic species, the peregrine falcon, no longer endangered. Come hear the courtship calls of spring. Somehow we feel Rachel Carson would want us to do this. The cliffs are silent no longer. And that's our focus on phenology for mid-April, nesting peregrine falcons. And for the listeners' benefit, there are peregrine falcons on the east side of the Iowa State Capitol. And this is Pat Schlarbaum with Local Talk this morning. We have a good program already planned out. So is Larry Stone going to be with us? He might be a frequent reminder for people that his journalism columns in the Des Moines Register kept us tuned in to his outdoor work. Good morning. Hello, Larry.
I'm here and enjoying your Rachel Carson and Bob Anderson and peregrine falcon story. Good.
And where do you live, Larry, these days?
I live at near Elkader along the Turkey River in Clayton County, northeast Iowa.
And I mentioned your journalism career with the Des Moines Register. What keeps you busy these days?
Grandkids, among other things, and enjoying the outdoors. I like to canoe, don't get out as often as I should. I like to do photography. I'm on our Clayton County Conservation Board.
Oh, sure.
And involved with other conservation, outdoor, trail-related, historical river projects, Motor Mill Foundation. There's a historic mill on the Turkey River that I work with. So I don't seem to have a lot of leisure time just to lay around. I get outside and do things.
Larry, we're kind of focusing on the Earth Day. I understand you were involved with some of those early activities. What year did you start?
I like to brag a little bit. I was at the University of Michigan as a graduate student in journalism in 1970, and a young, I think he was a Harvard student named Dennis Hayes had organized what he wanted to be the first Earth Day and set April 22nd for that day. Well, as it turned out, at the University of Michigan, our spring break was going to be during that week of April 22nd. So we moved our Earth Day ahead to the week before that, and so we were the first Earth Day. We weren't with the other 2,000 colleges and universities in the country having Earth Day on the 22nd. We were ahead of that. So, and it was an interesting time. There was the Black Action Movement, racial equality movement.
Yeah, a lot of tension in the country.
Vietnam War protests going on at that time. Things got a little hot and heated on some of the college campuses.
Is there anything that stands out from that first event in your
memory? There were several prominent speakers that came to the University of Michigan that spring. Ralph Nader was one, and he was then, as now, railing against corporate takeovers of politics in our economy and our country, and he was a passionate guy. Well, he had gotten some notoriety then for his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, I think it was called, the Corvair, Chevy Corvair was an automobile of that time, and he was accusing General Motors of not considering safety when they built and sold the Corvair.
So he was a strong advocate for the environment and also for protecting human life.
Another one was Paul Ehrlich, who had written The Population Bomb, essentially saying, hey, folks, we really need to not overpopulate the planet because we're going to use up our resources and destroy the human quality of life in the process. Another speaker was David Brower, who about at that time, he had been with the Sierra Club and eventually made the transition to a group called Friends of the Earth that he founded. So he was there, quite an inspirational speaker. Another one was Barry Commoner. He was a writer about that time. He had written Science and Survival, I think was the name of the book, and then a later one called The Closing Circle. He may have been one of the first to use the phrase, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Everything is connected, and no matter what we do, we're one way or the other, we're affecting the earth or paying for that.
Well, you sure had some heavy hitters there, some giants.
Yeah, we did.
Early
we did.
Movement.
So, and I was tangentially involved, not with those speakers, but I helped arrange some journalism speakers for a symposium we had. Robert Kahn, who used to write for the Christian Science Monitor, was their lead environmental writer. Edwin Newman, and I believe he was with maybe ABC TV, and he'd done some specials on the environment before then.
Well,
so we had kind of a full week of activities.
And what was the state of the environment there in Michigan? Were rivers catching on fire in Michigan in 1970?
Well, there's the old story about the Cuyahoga River, and I guess it was Cleveland. I can't remember the exact date of that, but yeah, the pollution was such that there was an oil spill or something, and it had caught on fire. Lake Erie was dying, they said, because of, I think, one of the reasons they gave at the time was phosphates in laundry detergent, and that was, I think, phosphates eventually were banned. There was quite a bit of air pollution, water pollution, and everything's relative. Now we think we've cleaned things up and things are getting better. But, yeah, there were some serious problems then. Pesticides, well, you mentioned DDT. The ban on that came in 1972. I remember as a student at the University of Michigan, I was doing an independent project about pesticides and their use and the dangers, and I was out with a film camera making a video of spraying DDT in the city of Ann Arbor. Oh, mosquitoes? I'm trying to remember.
Oh,
what
I'm
they
sure,
were.
Yeah.
But I was standing out there watching the plane, the helicopter go over spraying DDT. I think back and shudder at that.
Yeah. And later in your career then, how did you weave in that sort of prominence in your thinking about the environment in your later in your journalism career with the Des Moines Register?
Well, maybe a little background. I grew up on a farm in southern Iowa. My great-grandfather, about 100 years ago now, bought some land there, and as a progressive farmer, one of the first things that he did was to plow up some remnant prairie there, which happened to have some prairie chickens on it. I got this story from a neighbor who would, help plow up that land.
And when was that? When was it plowed?
About 100 years ago now, somewhere between 1915 and 1920,
okay,
roughly. So my grandfather, his son, was also a progressive farmer right after World War II. He was one of the first in the neighborhood to use DDT to control the flies around the livestock operation. And he told about hiring some people to come out to spray DDT, and they were all dressed up in their hazmat outfits and very how careful they were, but boy, they sure did kill the flies around the farm. So, and you know, with that kind of background, I went to school in biology at Coe College. Later, thought I was going to go into wildlife management and get a wildlife management degree, but had second thoughts about that and thought, you know, maybe communicating about the environment might be as good or better a way to get the message out as to be out working in the field as a biologist. Pat, you do a great job working in the field, and I guess I went slightly different direction. But
so. Well, you have certainly prospered in your outreach with the Clayton County Conservation Board. Those fundraisers that you have at the Elkader Opera House, we'll make sure that people are aware of those when that comes around in each autumn. And I'd like to ask you, what do you feel would be most beneficial for the environment in today's era?
Well, I always go back to Aldo Leopold, a native Iowan, author of the Sand County Almanac, and actually one of the founders of the modern conservation movement. I think the Sand County Almanac was published, I believe it was 1949.
Right.
And that, to a degree, was one of the bases for the modern environmental movement and Earth Day. But Aldo Leopold liked to talk about a land ethic, and essentially conservation is a state of harmony between man and the land, and how we treat the land says a lot about our society. Mm-hmm. And I think that Aldo Leopold liked to refer to it as an attitude. We need to have a better attitude toward realizing that we are not the masters of the land, but we are part of the community that involves the land. So,
yeah, and let's do that 365 days a year. There's a little bit of Earth Day in all of us each day. Larry, it's been great including you. Thanks for all that you do for conservation. We've got to have a little segue here into some Big Blue Sky music by John Stravers. And we've got Mark Edwards here in the studio. So we'll welcome that return with KHOI Community Radio 89.1 on your FM dial.
Thanks, Pat.
This old world keeps spinning around. Here in the studio to join us is Mark Edwards, a local environmentalist and outdoor activist. And it's so good to have
Morning,
you with
Pat.
Us.
Yeah, and your co-host Susan Franzen is still here with you.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I think we got John Strobbers on the line.
So, oh, great. Yeah.
Morning,
yeah.
John.
Good morning.
Hi, yeah. John. Yeah. Thanks for the music, John. Well, Mark, let's kind of learn a little bit more about your activities on an Earth Day.
Oh, well, let's see. They go on for, what, 45 years now?
Yeah.
So I've been a long participant. And I like to say, too, that, you know, you need to think about Earth Day every day. Mm-hmm. And things have really changed over the years, over the 45 years. And a lot of good things have happened, and we've still got a lot to discuss as the land changes in front of us. On the
it
uses.
Is an evolving picture.
Yes, it is.
It's good that Larry Stone could kind of get us grounded into how things were. And he mentioned there are some improvements, but my goodness, some monumental challenges
yes,
still
absolutely.
That we're still faced with. John, we can only appreciate your involvement up there on the Mississippi River in the highest regard. Tell us a little about your work with Audubon.
Well, it's all about the birds. It's all about taking care of the planet, you know. It's all about trying to live up to those ideals that Gladys Black set us up with years ago.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a matter of, what did she say? It's a matter of eternal
vigilance,
always trying to take care of what we have. And so I do some bird monitoring always with red-shouldered hawks, but now recently with cerulean warblers. But it's all about feeling connected to this living earth that we belong to.
And you do that, you express that so well in all your outreach. You are a musician. You do a lot of outreach with Audubon. And you do a lot of work on the local level as the Hawkman. Tell us a little bit about your activities in the Hawk Blinds.
Well, you know, it's there. We have we're along the Mississippi, along the bluffs here in the Driftless, of course. And some of your listeners know what that means. Others probably have a vague idea that in the northeast corner, there's just it's not as flat as it is the rest of the state, but some of the birds follow the Mississippi. Some of the birds come to the region because the entire region has some benefits for a migrant raptor. And so in the autumn, we're messing around with raptors as they migrate. And whew, we could get into all kinds of stories. But,
we caught
a bird that was banded in Greenland, and we caught her a few months later. We had a bird that was banded in Alaska, and she was coming through on Hawk Watch mm-hmm. weekend in October 99, yeah. And then we had a bird that was banded by a friend of mine who I helped get started in the business who captured the bird in Veracruz, Mexico 4 years before me, and then 4 years later I caught it here in the Luster Heights area in northeast Iowa.
And what would you like to share with our listeners here? We got just a couple minutes about what it means for John Strobers and the Earth Day activities.
Well, this time of year, I'm always out checking red shoulders, and there's a bird that keeps coming back to the same yeah. nesting sites.
Yeah.
So, I think that's people all have to find something that connects them to the earth in a stronger way, not just stories, but activities. Do something for the earth. Do something to make it a better planet. Help those who are making it a better planet.
Let's avoid complacency. Just tolerating these environmental issues is a matter of involvement that if we avoid complacency, we might be contributing to something of real value. Thanks for contributing to this program this morning, John.
Thank you for your work.
Yeah, well, thank you. Mark Edwards, what is it you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, getting here this morning early, it was wonderful to see everything. This is like the height of the wave coming back spring. I've been eating, you know, asparagus, morel mushrooms, fruit trees are all
Woo-hoo!
Blooming.
Yeah.
Leo is up in the Leo, the constellation, is up in the sky. I mean, it's just this is like the big wave coming in of growth and bursting of life.
Well, thank you for sharing those uplifting moments. So thank you again for this involvement. This is a great local talk show this morning. Thank you, Susan.
Well, this has been a great week that we have actually, you know, Earth Day was kind of slow getting off, but there are a couple big things today. One of them you heard about with our two guests earlier. Mm-hmm. And later this afternoon, KHOI will bring you the end of Ed Fallon's Bakken Pipeline Walk. And he's right now probably in a little bit making a speech at the very end of the trip up in northwest Iowa.
Wow.
And he's going to be with us live at 4 p.m. at the time of the usual Fallon Forum to tell what today is and to kind of sum up what he's experienced.
Well, how important is that?
Yeah.
A giant among us, Ed Fallon. Yeah.
And so we're very fortunate to have that at 4 p.m. And for those who can be in Des Moines at 6 p.m., why, there'll be a big rally at
7th
Avenue. Is that that's near the Capitol, isn't
that's it? That's right. Yeah. On the west side of the Capitol.
West side of the Capitol.
Find the crowd.
Yeah.
Find the crowd. And that's 5 to 6, so you can make it back or make it to a TV to watch that live link of Catherine Hale and what we're doing about climate urgency.
For Earth Day, we certainly want to remind people about the All Species, One Earth events at the Ames Public Library next Saturday, April 25th.
Could you talk a little about that, Mark?
Well, it sounds fun to me. It sounds costumes and a parade, and it'd be great for the kids. I mean, this will be a good way to plug in to other species.
And do you know Doug Woods and the band that's
playing
in the evening?
Yes, I do. Yeah, that's going to be very nice. Good music.
Yes. Yeah. So 2 to 3, parade. 3 to 5, there are wildlife exhibits. You know something about those?
A little bit. Just that I'm not sure who all the different groups are, but yeah, there's supposed to be each focus on each species thing, so it'll be interesting
at the library, and then a concert and
pre-concert
music and family in the evening.
Yes,
and he also writes children's books, so we've got the whole thing right across the street at the Ames Public Library.
And if you want to come learn about vegetated floating islands that will be happening on Lake Laverne on May 2nd, you should come to Parks Library outside and find a table.
We certainly want to mention the upcoming fund drive week.
Oh, yes. And I'd like to plug in that a lot because I'm very interested in environmental issues and everything, and this is one of the few places that I can get some in-depth looks at also on a national level, but with Sierra Sea Change Radio and things, but also locally what's going on. And to have these people, these giants of Iowa, John Stravers and Larry Stone have always been my heroes, and to have them on a program like this is fantastic.
Thank you, Mark. And next week during the fund drive, we'll have 3 live local talk programs on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. That's 9 programs in the week rather than just 3. On Wednesday, March 29th, I know we'll have different co-hosts and guests and music. So join us 3 times. This is KHOI Community Radio, and your hosts for this Earth Day program have been Pat Schlarbaum and Susan Franzen. Our guests have been Larry Stone, John Stravers, Mark Edwards, Chris Anderson, and Catherine Hayhoe. Local Talk is engineered by Rebecca Brown. Music you heard today was
Comes the Time. Comes the Time by the Big Blue Stand. Blue Sky Band from the CD Driftless Groove.
Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley. This local talk show will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. and you can also listen to it streaming live.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. Or stop by the Pantorium at 410 Douglas. And think about becoming a member next week during our membership drive. Your participation as listeners and contributors is what makes KHOI possible.
See you again on the radio.